Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And on our show today, we will be talking with the leader of the Waltham Research Program on Human-Animal Interaction about the health benefits of pets. We've got Dr. Sandra McCune with us today, Adam.
I'm looking forward to it. Do you have a pet, Christy?
I have two cats, but not a dog currently. Although my mom keeps saying she's going to buy one.
I've had dogs for all my life. I haven't had one for the last year, but I often say I've had dogs that have been part of my life longer than anyone else in my life.
Yeah,
This is really important.
I have a really,
look forward
really
to this
kitty.
Conversation. And we also have some really interesting research that matters, Christy. We're going to be able to talk today about this new cervical cancer vaccination and how often women should get pap screening.
About people trying to take selenium to decrease their lung cancer risk.
If anyone has a loved one in a nursing home and they need surgery, is it safe?
And about biofeedback to help kids with urinary problems.
Ooh, well, let's start right in here about this cervical vaccination. This is some interesting research that came out in the U.S. National Cancer Institute and some major journals looking at GlaxoSmithKline's Cervarix a vaccination, and its link, it's such its great reduction in cervical cancer that maybe we can cut down on screening because of the reduction in the risk of HPV, human papillomavirus.
Yeah. So, I mean, this vaccine is it's the only vaccine we have against cancer, and this in particular case, cervical cancer. But it's so effective based on all the studies to date that it looks like having a once-in-a-lifetime pap test at around the age of 25 to 30 just to check that the vaccine has been fully effective, could be the way to go. So that for all you women out there, if you get this vaccine as a child, then, or if our children do, going forward, they may not need to have pap tests the way that we've had to have them throughout our lives.
Yeah, there were two studies actually in the Lancet journal, and they were really looking at these vaccinations. And there is a rival drug maker, Merck, who makes a vaccine, HPV vaccine called Gardasil, but they protect against the 70 up to 80% potentially of the HPV cause of cervical cancers. And so you could potentially cut down drastically. I don't know though, Christy, if it doesn't seem like I'm not ready yet to make that recommendation cut down that quickly, but
I don't think anyone's ready. It's exactly how I took this as well. I don't think they're suggesting that we're going to make this change in recommendations yet, but it looks like it's so effective that we likely will be able to in the future if everyone gets the vaccine.
It won't be every year, certainly. And it's not every year now.
Right. It's decreased already to 2 to 3 years. But, you know, a lot of people find this vaccine controversial with kids. Are we giving them
a mixed message?
And
not
I'll tell
me.
You what, I'm going to do the very best I can to teach my daughter to make good choices and to abstain from sex, but I'm also going to give her this vaccine and protect her.
And my sons.
Yes, that's a whole nother ball of wax.
We'll get to that.
Right.
Speaking of another ball of wax, let's talk about this next research that matters. This study looking at selenium supplements as a way of lowering lung cancer risk.
So a lot of people have been trying to take this to decrease their lung cancer risk, particularly among heavy smokers.
Thinking that it might offer some benefit.
Yeah, thinking that maybe that would decrease their chance they catch lung cancer over time.
Because selenium's an antioxidant, so there's some theoretical rationale.
Yeah, so this study was in the European Respiratory Journal, or the Breathing Journal, looking at 3,300 older Danish men followed for 16 years, and these were people who were already heavy smokers. And they tested their blood selenium levels and followed that over time to see what happened in terms of getting lung cancer and dying.
Yeah, and unfortunately, we already know that heavy smoking is really linked with lung cancer, and so that 5% of the men or there were 6% at the lowest selenium levels died of lung cancer. But unfortunately, those at higher levels of selenium, 11%. Died. So that meant that selenium not only did not provide a benefit, it actually probably was worse.
Yeah, it's hard to understand exactly what that means, that those with the highest selenium levels had a greater risk of dying, but at least suggests that taking selenium is not a good idea. The best
That's what it means.
If you smoke, the best thing to do is to quit.
It's don't take selenium.
It's the single best thing you can do for your health.
Let's talk about another interesting research here about elderly patients. I've got many family members who are facing or have been in nursing homes. And there's a question here about an increased potential risk that they have when they have to have surgery. And so what does it really mean? Is it safe to have surgery when you're in a nursing home?
Yeah, they looked at even common surgeries that are generally considered lower risk surgeries and found that 12 out of 100 nursing home residents, in the case of their appendix, who had their appendix removed, died within the month of procedure, compared with just 2 out of the elderly people living on their own, suggesting that if you live in a nursing home and have the same surgery as someone not living in a nursing home, you're at much higher risk of death within a month of the surgery.
And they also found this similar disparate rates higher for people who are in nursing homes if they had to have colon surgery, if they had to have surgery because of bleeding ulcers. So I guess there's a bright side of this, which is that in the case of the ruptured appendix, 88 of the elderly nursing home residents actually survived. They did just fine. And the majority in all of these cases actually survived, but it was a harder course for them. It wasn't like, oh, they survived and there was no problems.
Right. Well, and also they tried, because initially you're like, well, people who live in nursing homes are likely to be older. They're likely to have other chronic medical problems that led to needing to be in a nursing home. They did try to control for those things in the study the way researchers do to account for that. But you can only account for it so much, I think.
And I think the bottom line here for me, Christy, is, and this article, by the way, was in the Annals of Surgery, but the bottom line here is that, you know, if you have an elderly loved one in a nursing home and they need surgery, they're probably going to need surgery, but you wonder if you can't maybe have some case managers or someone that really is out there in addition to your family and are looking out for them, and because this could be a hard process.
Yeah, and should be perhaps part of the conversation if the surgery is not absolutely mandatory.
Speaking of our last conversation for the research that matters, this is an interesting article about biofeedback that was in the Journal of Urology.
Well, and we know biofeedback help adults who have various problems related to the urinary tract. But this is looking at using biofeedback through video games to teach kids who wet their pants or have frequent urinary infections or even with constipation to kind of learn how to hold it in and learn when to let it go.
Right. And this was actually because they were the kids. They were getting what's called animated biofeedback. They were playing computer games along with looking at animated pictures of animals on the screen to help them learn to relax or to tighten up their muscles to help control their bladders. Very interesting and pretty impressive results.
Yeah, they compared the group who had the sessions of animated biofeedback with the computer to people, a group that was taught about changes in diet and behavior that it could improve their symptoms. And both groups got better. But the group who had the computer biofeedback got a lot better, 28% down to 8%.
Well, you know, Christy, this some of the research today, I mean, the biofeedback, children, animation, helpful, nursing home residents, surgery, they may need it, but boy, you got to have more attention.
That people taking selenium to decrease their lung cancer risk is not a good idea. You should quit smoking. And that the HPV and cervical cancer vaccines may cut the need for needing pap smear screening throughout one's life. I mean, this is really exciting research, Adam.
Yeah, I hope that we can continue to bring important work that can change people's lives for the better.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We'll take a short break. And when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Sandra McCune about the health benefits of pets. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're going to be talking with the leader of the Waltham Research Program on Human-Animal Interaction at the Waltham Center for Pet Nutrition in England, and editor of the book, The Health Benefits of Dog Walking for Pets and People, Evidence and Case Studies, Dr. Sandra McCune.
Dr. McCune, we are thrilled to have you with us today to talk a bit about the health benefits of pets.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
You know, one of the questions, this is a topic that Christy and I have discussed on research. We've been bringing research over the last couple of years where we see just research that pets actually have had benefits, not always, sometimes some injuries from pets, but research on this. And so when we saw your book, we said, wow, this is really something that we should talk about. Tell us a little bit how you yourself got interested in doing research on pets.
Okay, well, it started a long time ago. When I was 13, I started volunteering in an animal shelter in Dublin, in Ireland, which is where I come from. And I went on to do a degree in zoology and then went on to do a PhD in animal behavior, looking at cat and dog behavior, and have always been fascinated by animals and everything they do, and particularly what happens when people and pets get together. So the job I do now is to head up a research program that looks in studies, looks at the research into that interaction between what happens when people and pets interact.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what we know about what happens. I mean, just thinking of my own, I'm a cat person. I have these two cats, and I don't give them enough attention now that I have children. But when I'm holding them, I mean, there's something special about holding and loving an animal. And it's exciting to see the research coming out showing some health benefits. But what, from your perspective, are the benefits, or what is the essence of that human-animal bond?
Well, I think that bond is a really special bond. And I think there's several things that make it really special that are sort of similar to our bond with people, but also different. And so you've touched on something really important there, Christy. It's about being able to touch animals and pets. And that certainly, we know now from studies that increases our oxytocin levels, the feel-good hormone that, you know, mm-hmm. we have. But there's also lots of other benefits as well. So there's the direct kind of interaction benefits. But we know that they can act like stress buffers for us, so they make us calmer when we're around them. And that actually extends into actually having benefits for our heart health. And of course, many people will walk their dogs if they have dogs. And so you get a lot of additional benefits through exercising with your pet, as well as just having a pet around, you know, and obviously that extends to other species like cats and other species. And we know that they can help us stay healthy in all sorts of ways. And that's not just the physical things I've mentioned, but also psychologically as well, but better for our mental health.
So this idea of increasing the oxytocin levels and the feel-good hormone, does that just apply to dogs and cats, or is that any animal, like if I had a pet tiger or something?
So that may be other species, but actually we're only at the very beginning, really, of that work. It's an intriguing area, and the work that's been done so far has all been done in dogs. And I think what's fascinating is not only that when people interact positively with their dogs, they get an oxytocin peak, which makes them feel good. And, you know, you get that really nice close feeling and uh-huh. trusting feeling. But also the dogs get it. We know that also get this peak in oxytocin as well. So it's a mutual bond. It is two-way.
Christy, I'm a little worried about the tiger part
of
it.
I was thinking
that you were going to say about horses or about, you know, frogs or turtle or something. Tigers?
I was thinking of a scary pet, like that's still,
yeah,
random.
The petting there. But Dr. McCune, you know, I remember when I first came to North Carolina well over a decade ago, but I came across in Western North Carolina a group that was doing pet therapy with not exotic animals, but like small ponies and other things. And they were going into schools and they were going into hospitals and bringing those that were ill. And I had never seen that. Is this idea of pet therapy, using pets for psychological or serious illnesses, or even with physical therapy, is this a relatively new field, or is this something that actually has been around but we just don't know about it?
No, you're right. It is relatively new, although it's had its beginnings, you know, maybe 40 years ago. But in fact, it's becoming increasingly popular, and animals are used as therapy partners in all sorts of ways. So they can have a strictly therapeutic sort of role where they, you know, there are clinical goals around the interaction with the animals. But actually, much more commonly is that pets will go in, be taken in on visitation programs, or they will be, you know, taken into prisons where the prisoners can actually train the animals or foster those animals and help them grow into adult dogs. There's a whole range of ways, some of which help the animals and some of which help the people. But now you will quite commonly see dogs or other animals present in hospital waiting rooms, in, you know, doctors' waiting rooms even, you see some.
And
that's all around reducing the stress levels, really, of the people and calming them and, you know, just letting them chill out and not be threatened by the therapy session that they're in.
In thinking about the different populations that have been studied to benefit from pet therapy, I'm thinking about patients in nursing homes or perhaps patients with mental illness, and you mentioned several others. What do you, from your perspective, is the group that can most benefit from animal interaction?
Well, I think in a therapeutic sense, you know, probably it is a more general effect, actually, of pets acting as stress buffers. So although there are lots of specific, you know, ways in which they are used therapeutically, I think it is just that amazing ability that pets have to get alongside, you know, children and adults, whoever, and just make the whole situation that they're in less threatening. And so what happens then is that they become more relaxed and more accessible to whatever therapeutic context that they're in. And the very beginnings of this field really go back to a psychologist called Boris Levinson. And what he found when he was working with children, and particularly nonverbal children, that when he brought his own pet dog into the office, he had a very different response from those children. And some of those children spoke for the first time when he had his dog with him. And they spoke to the dog, not to him. But he found he could, you know, start making links that way through the dog to the child. And that was really what sort of triggered a lot of people thinking, well, what is this? Is there something more here that we can use in a wider therapeutic sense? And people started to explore it scientifically.
No, I was going to say, we're talking with Dr. Sandra McCune about health benefits of pets. And, you know, as you're talking, Dr. McCune, about the pets, and we all see and feel this, and I was recently visiting my son up at college and happened to walk past a beautiful golden retriever. And, of course, it reminded me that I had lost a golden retriever a year ago, and that's the third golden retriever over 30 years that I've lost. Talk for a minute about, because animals, for the most part, die sooner. Not all, but many pets die much sooner than humans do. And is that a problematic? And what does your research show?
Yes. So they do die, obviously, a lot earlier than we do. And so if you have had several pets in your lifetime, you expect to see, you know, the joy of puppies and kittens, but also the loss of those animals when they're elderly. And what we know is that that's really hard for some people. That's very hard. And indeed, it's so extreme for some people that it's enough of a reason for them not to get another pet. But actually, most people do go on, and they don't replace that character, but they replace having a pet in their life, is how most people tend to view it. What we do know is that there are benefits for children experiencing that bereavement process with a pet in terms of their ability to deal with that situation when they're older, when it comes to bereaving a lost person in their lives. And so there are actually benefits to that, as well as it being really hard. And I've lost pets myself. I know how hard that can be at times.
Well, but before we take a break, let me just ask, do you have a little advice for our listeners about when you have experienced a loss of a pet? What tips would you have for our listeners about how to help resolve that grief?
Well, I think the first thing is to realize that it's fine to feel deeply, deeply sad and distressed even when you lose a pet, because these bonds can be incredibly strong that we have with pets. And so the first thing is to sort of realize, actually, lots of other people go through this as well, and what you're feeling is just normal. And then I think the other thing to do is, you know, if it persists or you don't have somebody that you can confide in your own circle of friends. And let's face it, most of us have pets. You know, about 2/3 of households in the U.S. have pets. So talk to somebody who's also gone through a similar experience. But if you want, you know, if you want a bit more counseling further than that, then go and talk to your vet, and they can refer you for bereavement counseling specifically for pet loss. And I think that can be very useful. The other thing I think that can be useful is there are, you know, quite a lot of sites now that enable you to leave some sort of a tribute to your pet. And a lot of people find that helpful as well. So I think what I would say is, don't just, you know, feel like you should just get over it, actually. These are real feelings, and they're valid feelings. And I think often people do need to find some way of coping with them.
Well, that sounds like wise advice. We do need to take a short break, but when we come back, we will continue talking with our guest, Dr. Sandra McCune, about the health benefits of pets. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Adam and I have been talking with Dr. Sandra McCune, the editor of the book, The Health Benefits of Dog Walking for Pets and People, and a fascinating person who knows a lot about the research around the health benefits of pets. Dr. McCune, thank you for extending our conversation with you. I know Adam and I both have a lot of patients who have pets and both have pets ourselves, and it's important to sort of tie in some of the context.
You know, Dr. McCune, last evening, I was actually out in the community, and one of our patient and a listener to the program came up to me and said, I have started exercising with my pet, but the pet wants to go a lot faster than I'm able to go. And I started thinking, yeah, I could see that commonly. So starting exercising with your pet may not be as easy as it sounds. Give us some what we know from your research, from the book that you've edited, and your own experience. How does this work?
So dog walking is fairly straightforward. You know, anybody really can do it, has a healthy dog and are reasonably healthy themselves. And the great thing is, you know, you can start at any level. It's accessible. You can do it. You don't have to get lots of equipment, you know, or kit to do it. You can just get out there and do it. And really the key things are just, you know, pairing yourself with a dog. Ideally one that's sort of matched approximately to your energy level is what we would suggest. But, you know, often what we find is that people, if they have a dog and they haven't been walking it, actually both of them need to start at a reasonably gentle level and then build that up. And so beyond that, then, it is about some very basic training, really, for the dog. So having a leash, having, you know, a degree of leash control. If you're going to go to a dog park, then having some recall control for the dog, so the dog will come back to you when it's called. But other than that, you know, really, there's very little preparation needed to get out there and just go and have a walk and see how it goes and build it up from a slow beginning, you know, and just increase it over time.
You know, in thinking about the obesity epidemic in our country, and I know that there's a problem with our pets being overweight as well. But thinking about inactivity and so many of the recommendations for lifestyle change that Adam and I make to patients every day and to our listeners every time we're on the show, what do we know about our advice? Like, should we be recommending to our patients who can afford it and who maybe safety is not as much of an issue, they're able to walk? Should we be recommending that our patients go out and get a pet?
Well, I think it's a great idea to certainly walk with a pet. And I think, you know, either people can build that into their idea of getting a pet, but there are other considerations that they really need to go through carefully before they get a pet. But what you can do is, if you have a pet already and you're not walking, you can walk it, or you can walk somebody else's pet, but they're not walking, or even if they do walk, dogs will never say no to a walk. They love it.
Like babysitting, you can give it back if you're not ready to commit to the full care.
Yeah, and I think that's a great way of doing it, you know, where people can, people do that in the village that I live in. You know, people come sometimes and ask, can I take out my dog? So I'm just back from my 45-minute walk in the evening. My dog's here beside me, Josie, and we've just had a great walk. But, you know, sometimes at the weekends or whatever, I have two kids in the village who will come and ask, can they take Josie out? They don't own dogs themselves, but it's a great way for them to get some good interaction with a dog. So you don't actually have to own a dog yourself, but I think ultimately, you know, that's where it works best. Is if you have a dog, you walk it, and that really builds the bond between the two of you.
Well, and I think it sounds like, you know, you do need to, the dog needs to go outside, and so it forces you to go outside that you might not otherwise. I don't know what the weather's fully like there in England right now, but I bet it can get cold.
You're absolutely right. It's an absolutely typical December evening here. So I'm in pitch black. It's very cold indeed tonight. It's pretty wet as well. And I know that if I didn't have my dog Josie beside me wanting to get out for a walk, then I'd probably be sitting in front of the TV like everybody else. So they are fantastic motivators for physical activity. We know that. And, you know, we know that from our own lives, but we also know that from studies where, you know, we know that dogs actually are great motivators for elderly people. And in a study that we're doing with Rebecca Johnson of Missouri University, when we paired elderly people with shelter dogs who needed walking, we found it was in fact only the group who had a dog walking companion rather than a human walking companion that significantly increased their mobility in a timed test, which was great news for elderly people because that's what we want, you know, just keeping functional levels really, really high.
The other thought is about socialization. And so, you know, I have friends who talk about, you know, wanting to move to a new town and you want to meet new people, that having that pet or having that dog, they meet people at the dog park or they meet other people walking their dogs. What do we know about any benefits of socialization, perhaps, for people who are isolated?
We know actually quite a lot about this now. And what we know is, you know, whereas a lot of the early work was around understanding, if you like, the benefits of having a dog in your life and for the individual, we now know that actually that there's a community benefit from that as well. So if you go out with a dog, you know, we know you're much more likely to get spoken to by people. They'll talk to you for longer about more things. And that holds true even if you take out, you know, one of the guardian breeds, so it looks a bit sluggish, and you also dress up the person to look like a homeless person, you know, so you don't necessarily make them the most socially attractive looking. But even still, that sort of social lubrication effect, as it's called, is maintained. And it's a fantastic way of getting to know your neighbors.
They did a study making the people look like they were not desirable to talk to, and they were, even if they had a dog, people were more likely to talk to them?
That's right, yeah.
Wow.
So it cuts across class and appearance, and, you know, a few things do, really. So,
Christy,
you know,
that's people,
really cool.
People will come talk to you, Christy.
Like, they'll talk to you.
This is a way of dealing with your social isolation. Dr. McCune, we're talking with Dr. Sandra McCune, international researcher on pets and your health. And Dr. McCune, I guess one of the questions I have is, certainly, pet therapy, having a pet, there's got to be times in which there are some safety risks involved. I've had a number of patients who have taken their pets out and have actually fallen, tripped, and broken bones here. Talk a little bit about the safety risk, and are there individuals really for whom perhaps having a dog might be problematic?
Yes, there certainly are, you know, problems do arise. And so some of the issues that can arise when you share your home with a pet are, for example, bites. Trip hazards for elderly people would be, you know, a classic one. And also there are, you know, some low risks, but there are risks nonetheless of some diseases which can be transmitted from pets to people. What I would say is, for all of those, I think, you know, you can very radically reduce the risk of those by doing a few simple, you know, things. And that would involve obviously keeping your pet healthy, keeping it regularly wormed. But also another important aspect of it is the behavior of that pet. And so the importance of early socialization, for example, so that your pet is well controlled, you know, it sits down, nothing else is happening. The default position is to sit and wait, you know, for guidance. I find that really useful with a big Labrador in my house. There's lots going on. And there's lots you can do, you know, in terms of reducing those risks. Obviously, dogs should be introduced to children, many children, when they're young and socialized so they grow up to not be frightened of children or indeed of other sorts of people, like elderly men or one group of people that sometimes frightens the dogs unintentionally. And it's about introducing your dog to a whole range of people and events and situations so that it is really sort of bomb-proof later on.
We know,
and doesn't get scared.
Dr. McCune, you mentioned before we started the show, you mentioned this program called The Power of Pets and this partnership with the Y. And I wonder if you'd just touch on that briefly. I know we're going to have to wrap up in just a minute, but it sounds
sure.
like a powerful program.
Sure. So the Power of Pets is a community-focused initiative that Mars Petcare runs, and they kicked it off last year, and really the whole focus of it is to celebrate pets and pets ownership and the bonds of that within the community. And it's really trying to encourage people and families in particular to get active with their pets. So it's this social aspect that you mentioned, you know, of just getting out there with your pet, having a great time, making it fun, but also getting a bit of education, you know, being able to try out things like agility or training, whatever, and just getting out there and being active. It's all about promoting physical activity.
Wonderful. We should put a link up on our blog if there's a website reference that you could have for us about that Power of Pets partnership.
Sure, there sure is. I'll send that to you.
Well, Dr. McCune, we want to really thank you for being a guest with us on Your Health. For our listeners, maybe you can join us behind the scenes. We'll have a couple other things that we can talk about. But it's really been wonderful to extend the conversation from the office to the home to the park into the community that you're allowing us to do. So thank you so much for your work and research and for our listeners.
Thank you, Dr. McCune.
Thanks very much.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I are going to take a few minutes to talk about your health questions and concerns.
If you have a question for us to address, send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And let's listen, Christy, to our very first house call from a listener today.
Dear Dr. Goldstein and Page, I have a friend who was recently told she had Charcot-Marie-Tooth disease. What is this? And is it something I can get from a virus? It sounds scary.
Charcot-Marie-Tooth disease. That is a really interesting question and a really important disease.
It is. And I do have a patient that we care for who has Charcot-Marie-Tooth disease, and it's something that's important to think about, particularly when one enters that childbearing time and decisions about having children, because this is something that is passed down through families that affects the nerves outside of the brain and spine, what's called the peripheral nerves, and can cause all kinds of problems with your muscles and nerves and ability to walk.
Yeah, I've got, unfortunately, several patients and sometimes their family members, Christy, as well. And I think it's good that this question comes in because it does allow us to talk about it, because it is a little scary, because the symptoms can include all kinds of problems with the nerves and inability to control the legs and the arm muscles, and sometimes some what's called contractures, where the hands and arms get stiff and weakness. Most times people, though, live the same life expectancy of someone mm-hmm. who doesn't have it, but they'll have disabilities.
So you ask about, can you get it from a virus? Our understanding of Charcot-Marie-Tooth disease is that this is a genetic problem that happens and is passed down through families, and that you wouldn't get from hanging around a person who has the illness. And thankfully, we've got new forms of physical therapy and occupational therapy and orthopedic treatments that can help people be able to live to their maximum with the disease.
And your friend will need your support. So thanks for your question, and we hope that things will go well. Let's listen to our very next house call.
When you have severe pain in your low back so bad that you cannot stand up, how long should you wait until you see a doctor? How long should you wait until you start physical therapy? And how long should the doctor wait until they order an MRI?
Low back pain, so very common.
Severe pain.
So very common. The good news is that most people with what we call acute low back pain, that's been more recent, most people get better. So the good news is that most people get better.
And I guess, you know, the question, you have three really good questions here. How long should you wait till you see a doctor? Well, I guess from our perspective, that's a tough one. Most of us would probably say, well, if it's so bad that you need some relief and you really want some medication and what you're trying is not working, I'd come in and see the doctor. Most people don't come in, I don't think, too soon.
And a question about starting physical therapy, most doctors will send you to physical therapy after 4 or 6 weeks if you're still continuing to have pain or not improving. A lot of the physical therapists don't quite want to see you right when you're having the worst kind of pain because it's hard for you to be able to do things. But usually after it's settled down a little bit, that physical therapy can be very helpful for improving this problem and also preventing future ones.
And even if you don't see a physical therapist, getting physical therapy and talking with your doctor about low back strengthening exercises and way to strengthen your quadriceps and your hamstrings and your core muscles, really important. And both Christy and I would strongly recommend that as soon as you're feeling stronger, you start on those because that can help prevent future injuries.
The decision about an MRI really depends on your specific symptoms and scenario. If you've had a major trauma or some big car accident or something, then doing more detailed imaging might be helpful. Or if you're having any weakness or numbness or other, or certain signs that we look for and that we'll ask you about that might lead a doctor to order an MRI. But it's not helpful for everyone to just get an MRI.
Yeah, most times it probably doesn't need to be done and certainly doesn't need to be done quickly in most circumstances. But thank you so much for a really wonderful question. And Christy, let's listen to our very next house call.
Dear House Calls, I was told that I may have a sleeping problem called REM sleeping disorder, whereby I sometimes act violently in my sleep, such as striking my partner. How do I diagnose and treat it? Can it be cured? As you can probably understand, it's a pretty frightening disease.
Wow.
We're getting some interesting questions about some things that we see, not commonly, but we do see them.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about what is REM sleep behavior disorder. This is a disorder that some people have during a certain state of sleep called the REM sleep, where you tend to be more paralyzed and having dreams and that sort of thing, where people will enact their dreams, or in your case, it sounds like, you know, hitting your partner. That actually happened to me once. My husband hit me in the face in the middle of the night.
On purpose?
He was in his dream. He was defending someone and fighting.
He was probably in this REM sleep.
He was.
Yeah. Did he apologize the next morning?
I mean, I woke up crying. I'd just been hit in the face. It was bizarre. But we're still together. And
does he have a REM sleep disorder? Or we can't talk about
that. Well, no, this was just one time that it happened. Thankfully not.
But if this were to happen repeatedly, and we hear this story sometimes where people wake up and they're flailing their arms and their and then you would worry that possibly there's this disturbance of the REM sleep cycle, which you really need for restorative sleep, and it can be dangerous to the partner.
It sure can. And the way to diagnose this is to get a formal sleep study where, you know, they hook you up to all kinds of monitors and videotape you and watch what you do in your sleep in the night. And there can be some treatments with certain medications like benzodiazepines or medicines.
Those kind of Valium type drugs.
Yeah, that type of drug. And so there can be treatments if that's in fact, the diagnosis that you have.
And unfortunately,
that's tough.
The cause is unknown, and there is some association with Parkinson's disease and in this area, and particularly among older men. But, you know, this is one of those things you're going to work with your primary care doctor, you're going to work with your neurologist, and you're going to work together as a team with your loved one and your spouse and to really help manage this.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be managed. So thank you for the question.
Absolutely. Let's take our last house call question.
Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page, I know that recently people around the U.S. celebrated the Great American Smokeout, and people always tell about their experience trying to quit. Well, I did it 1 year ago with the help of specialists at the UNC Nicotine Dependence Program. It can be done, and I encourage any smoker out there to keep trying. I'm glad I did.
Congratulations. That's a great story.
We are happy. Yeah, I think it was just like the 34th anniversary of the Great American Smokeout. And so that is a good story.
It is wonderful. And, you know, I can sing the song of the UNC Nicotine Dependence Program. It's Adam's program, but I benefit from it, of being a provider at the Family Medicine Center. We can refer patients to this program that is so effective in helping people quit. And it sounds like it was effective for you. So I'm really glad to hear that. Quitting smoking is the single best thing you could do for your health. So you should celebrate.
And the good news is you don't actually have to see me. they will see a tobacco treatment specialist whose job it is to full-time work with them on the plans to quit, to figure out what the barriers to long-time quitting, and to figure out how to stay quit successfully. You know, we say the Great American Smokeout Day is one day a year when people kind of make a vow to quit smoking. But I say, why not use the other 364 days of the year to make that vow? And if you had to smoke that one day, you're do it on that one day. But we're so glad that you were able to quit. And that's a great way to actually conclude our house calls
today.
It
sure is. We talked a little bit about quitting smoking. And again, congratulations.
About knowing about REM sleep disorder is treatable and hopefully cutting down on any accidents that happen to spouses in bed.
And a little bit about Charcot-Marie tooth disease and about low back pain. Thank you for your questions and for joining us today on Your Health. We hope that we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to you and to your health. And we want you to share your questions, share your stories. Email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. And you can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and now iTunes.
And we'd like to thank the staff of WCHL, the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. And our guest today, Dr. Sandra McCune. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
We will look forward to talking with you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360 WCHL. Plays here. UNC's flagship station. This is News Talk 1360 WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's News, Talk, and Tar Heel station.